I don't know if it's something you ever get used to. Like, I accept my body, but I'm still not used to it. So my daughter, the second daughter, she'll be 21 this year, 22 years. I just learned to live with how it is. Say, well, that's beautiful or anything like that, because I'm not really happy with how I look on the inside. But, you know, what a blessing we get to wear clothes.
Kia ora and welcome back to the C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Helen King, and this is the podcast for cancery people who want real conversations about cancer. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe on Spotify or wherever you listen to good podcasts. Today's episode was such a pleasure to put together. I kept getting tingles during the interview and as I edited it together. Interviewing my guest today was one of those times where even though the other person is a stranger, you have this connection or you have this shared experience, and there, I guess it creates this moment in time where you have a connection, where you just really, you relate to an experience that only someone else who has been through it can understand. And I feel really lucky because I get to talk to a wide range of people about their cancer experiences. Cancer is such a private and often really painful experience, but I feel really humbled because my guests often trust me with their story. And I guess that's how the interview with my guest today really left me feeling. Michelle Treadaway O'Hare is a school teacher from Kirikiri Roa or Hamilton. I came across her story on Waka Huia, and I knew I needed to get in touch with her and see if she'd come on the C Word. Her segment on Waka Huia covered her journey to get a moko kowai, and I will put the link to the episode in the show notes, and I highly recommend that you watch it. Michelle was told 22 years ago she may not live to see her young daughter grow up. She had just lost a pregnancy when she was dealt another blow with the diagnosis of breast cancer. This is Michelle's story.
In 1998, I think it was, when I was 28, I was actually pregnant at the time. My husband and I were expecting our second baby. And at the time when I was pregnant, I could feel a lump in my breast. And then during that pregnancy, our baby only grew to 18 weeks before he died. So, for 10 weeks, it was fairly small, but by the time we got to 16, 17 weeks, it was the size of a tennis ball almost. So I went to the doctor, and going through that, the traumatic time of losing our baby, that was really traumatic. But then a couple of weeks later, I said to the doctor that the lump is still there, because they had told me that just because you're pregnant, that different things happen in your breasts at the time. But then, after probably a couple of weeks later, it was still there. So I went into the breast clinic and had the biopsies. Then the week later, I found out that I had breast cancer. And it was something hard to fathom, actually, because I was the first person in my family to be diagnosed with breast cancer. No breast cancer in my mother's generation, none of my grandmother's generation. So I suppose it started from there. And at the time, we had a five-year-old daughter. It was really, just dramatic, I suppose, because I was so young.
Yeah, you were so young. And I just imagine, when you're going through that process of losing a child, which is unimaginable, I think that's it's a very deep grief when that happens. And then to have the double whammy of, oh, by the way, you also have breast cancer. I mean, I can't even imagine having to sort of process both of those at the same time.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, it was really traumatic. I had to take a lot of time off work just to cope with losing our baby. Yeah, and then getting the breast cancer. You go through all of the thoughts, so like, why me? And, how when you have to have the mastectomy and all treatment, and then you hear from the doctors, that you have to work on your relationship because a lot of men leave their woman when these sort of things happen because they can't cope with the loss of, the breast and then all of that type of thing you have to cope with. And even going to the breast clinic and you're the only young person there, probably by, 40 or so years, and they're asking if you're here to support your mother or your grandmother. Where my file was like this thick. And, yeah, it was just...
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because my partner and I had been together for about 6 months before I was diagnosed, and because I hadn't had children at that stage, had to go through that, you know, getting eggs harvested and things, and having to make decisions really quickly of should we get embryos fertilized, you know, and all of that stuff. And also knowing, yeah, that a lot of relationships don't survive the cancer experience. It is a really huge load to be carrying when you're going through that. But I really got the sense from the segment on Wakahuia that your husband is like, he wasn't going to leave. He was, you know, he looked like just a strong person in your life.
My husband is probably, he's a gift from God. I think, you know, one of those sort of people that are given to you as a gift. He's a loyal, wonderful, beautiful man. And I'm pretty sure, more than 100% sure, that he that thought never would have even entered his mind. You know, like every day since I've met him, he wakes up and he tells me that I'm beautiful and all of those sorts of things, and nothing's ever changed him. He never sees anything different.
Yeah.
You know, in me as a different person.
Yeah.
But I feel, you know, because it's sort of traumatic when you go through all of those, the operations and how you look, those sorts of things. It didn't faze him a bit, you know. And he had to help me work through all of that, how to cope with, you know, with those challenges in my life at the time.
Yeah. And it is huge, isn't it? Because I didn't have reconstruction. So just that. I don't know how you prepared for it, but because I went very into a logical frame of mind leading up to the surgery, and then, you know, I had it and I couldn't even look down, even with the gown on after the mastectomy. And then seeing it for the first time, even though I looked at, you know, pictures on the internet of women with mastectomy scars and things, it didn't prepare me to see myself without a breast. Was it similar for you? Was it sort of having to go, wow, that's, you know, that's my body now?
It was totally similar for me. You can't prepare for it, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know what it feels like until you've experienced that. You can see books and you think that, you know, other people look great and that, and, you know, when it's yourself, I feel that's a totally different experience that you can't explain unless you've actually been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And because what really struck me was when I, you know, read about, you know, before your segment on Wakahuia, that the doctors didn't think you were going to survive. And I thought, that's huge. That's a really challenging sort of prognosis to be given. What stage were you at when you were diagnosed, and why did they sort of think this, you know, this may not be a long prognosis?
I don't really remember what stage it was on the scale type thing, because at the time I was like still traumatized from losing the baby, because we had the baby at the end of November and in January. This has sort of happened December, January, late December, so a month later. So I still hope through all of those things. When I got told that, yeah, for Watson and I, we've got a lot of faith. We've got faith in the Lord. And I believe that it's the faith and the prayer that got me through. And I'm quite a stubborn person. So, like, a strong, sort of stubborn person, and I feel like I just would never. I have a sporting background, but a competitive sporting nature, and I wasn't gonna let it beat me at the time, you know, because all I could think about was we had our 5-year-old daughter, Hanate Kōwhai, and didn't want her to be brought up without a mum, you know, and I was thinking, who's going to, you know, make sure that her hair's brushed properly and teach her all these things that she needs to learn. And I was just adamant that I wasn't going to let it beat me. And then even at the time, the doctor said to me, you know, if you're lucky enough to survive, then you won't be able to have any more children because of the treatment that your body has to go through. After I finished my last round of radiation, I got pregnant with our second daughter, Maioha. Yeah, and so Maioha to us means like just being thankful and appreciative. Yeah, so I'd go to the breast clinic with this new baby. Hannah was at school, and then they'd say, oh, here comes the miracle baby. Here's the miracle baby. And then 5 years later, we were blessed with a third baby, and we named her Te Aho Mai, which is blessings from above, because we just believed that these girls were, you know, gifts from God.
Oh, I'm getting chills when you're talking about that. It's just so, I just imagine part of healing, because I think that something we often don't talk about is actually, we physically heal, I think, from cancer, but the physical or mental or spiritual healing that we need to do afterwards is quite immense. And when you're talking about, you know, having these babies that, you know, the doctor said you probably won't have, I can only imagine how it's almost like soothing for the soul that, you know, that these babies came into your life.
Yeah, definitely soothing for the soul.
Yeah.
At the time, because I went with the reconstruction.
Yeah.
But then I wanted to breastfeed both of the girls on the one side. Yeah. Which is one big, huge inside, and then the reconstructed one just sort of stayed how it was supposed to stay. And, you know, in hindsight, now that I'm 50 years old, I'm thinking, oh, I got the double mistake. But, you know, because I was thinking, oh, feeding the baby for, I don't even know how long, 1 year, eight months or something. And then, you know, but then after that one year period, you're like stuck like this for the rest of your existence.
Yes.
Didn't really think that through, did I?
Oh.
You don't expect to make all these sorts of decisions when you're in your 20s and 30s, do you?
No, not at all. And it's really tough, isn't it? Because I think unless you have gone through it, you don't realise that you really are thrown onto this path that goes very quickly. And all of a sudden, you're having to make very quick decisions about things that actually potentially could have a very big outcome on things. And I don't know. I think the first time I almost stopped and went, wow, okay, I have cancer, was when chemo started, because everything else had been so quick that I remember sitting there, and I'd shaved my head in preparation because I knew my hair was going to fall out, and I just had my port put in, and I think I was about to have chemo and thinking, what on earth is happening? How did I get here?
Yeah, it all sort of went really quick for me in the beginning, you know, how I was diagnosed, and that following maybe 3 or 4 days later, because I worked at a school in Huntley called Rākaumanga, a group of our teacher friends were going over to Australia at the end of that week. So I called all our friends together and said, oh, we're going to have a kaitahi, you know, like a shared meal midweek, and that I have to, of some news I need to share with everybody. So I called them all together with my family and close friends, and I told them that we had cancer. So that happened really quickly, and we were supposed to go to Australia. Actually, it was the following morning, or the following day sometime. And I wasn't going to go because I was thinking, how can we go on this trip while I'm trying to deal with, you know, being told that you have cancer the day prior to that. So we had the kai anyway. And then the next morning, my family said, you need to still go, you and Watson go on this trip. So we went, and then when we were away, we got the phone call to say that I'd been booked in to the hospital 2 days after we were returning from Australia. It was a miracle, because at the time they said that they couldn't get the gynecologist, the surgeon and the reconstruction guy all together until another couple of months down the track. But my mother and father-in-law, they're Christians, and they were just praying night and day, you know, that day and that night. And then we got the phone call, so it was a little bit of a miracle. So that part happened so quickly. And then the chemotherapy part, I was the same as you, you know, wondering. It wasn't until then that I really, you have to slow down because you're forced to slow down. And that it really hit me that, oh my gosh, I've got cancer. And, you know, because I didn't shave my hair straight away. One of the mornings I woke up and there was a big clump of hair on the pillow, and it took me over the edge, picking the clump of hair, and Watson took me down to the hairdresser straight away. Ella took me down, and then we got it all, an offshore, and I don't even know what the, you know.
Yeah, because I wasn't coping with the clumps of hair.
And it wasn't until, yeah, the chemotherapy, that's when you really, when you know, because everything is happening. There's that, there's all the vomiting. There's just the feeling sick, sitting in the room, well, on the bed or on the lazy boy, all hooked up to the, my medicine was this bright red.
I had that too, yes.
People sort of something or other. You know that.
I had that too, yeah.
Oh, gosh. And then you're sitting with the elderly, mm-hmm. you know, and that's when I was thinking, what is happening to me?
Yeah.
Why am I all the nans and cuddles and...
I exactly the same. I had the AC chemo, the Red Devil, and exactly the same in those infusion rooms was often the youngest person by 20, 30 odd years. Yeah. And you could sort of see the sort of look at, oh, what's happened to you?
What are you doing here? Yeah. Oh my God, this sounds really sad, but I wish you were around in my time.
Yeah.
We would be friends.
Yeah. Definitely, because it is such a different experience. I mean, how do you parent as well? I mean, you have a 5-year-old daughter at the time. How do you keep things? How do you parent through chemo? How do you did you try and keep normality? Or
I took time off work. I was a teacher at Ākaumanga, like I mentioned, in Huntly. Our house was probably maybe 100 meters away from the school, so Watson still went to work, and he'd back and visit me during the breaks. And my sister-in-law, the one who's getting married today, she actually left her job for a few months to come and look after me and Watson and our baby girl. So, you know, the sacrifice that she makes, she was a teacher as well, but that sort of aroha that you have, you know, it's something that you can just never repay that. Yeah, so, oh my gosh, it's a little bit emotional just thinking about that sacrifice that she made for us.
You're so loved though, and that's really the sense that I got. And I'll post the clip of the Wakahuia, the link to it, because it is such a beautiful story. But I really did get that sense of how loved you are, you know, with your whānau all around you during the process. That, you know, you're in this room of people and they're all kind of holding you through that. I mean, you had that during cancer, I would imagine, too, of these people walking with you, holding you through it.
I was, I suppose I've just really had quite a blessed life, I suppose. You know, when you can tend to focus a lot on the negative side of things, like why did it happen to me and why do I look like this and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, when you focus on the positive side of things, you know, I've really got an amazing family, and that's both sides. The Treadaway side, that's my family, and my Ōhia side, Watson's family, and our close group of friends who are family as well. You know, so with both sides of our family, we're all interconnected with our friends. We have groups of friends called the usuals, which are ones that we can, you know, then we've got all the interwoven friends. Once you're a friend with one of us in either family,
yes.
Then you become one of the family for all three groups. No, you don't really realize how lucky you are until, you know, like till you ask the question, then, you know, you're reminded of how fortunate you really are.
I remember seeing a quote or someone saying that somewhere, that you don't realize how loved you are until you get cancer. Yeah, and I found that very true, because I was exactly the same as you. No one in my family had had breast cancer. Mum had had a gynae cancer years ago, and I think, you know, like a cousin on dad's side, but there was no one immediate that had had cancer, and so it came out of nowhere. And I think when we are young, when it happens, it's quite shocking. It is sort of strange when someone young and fit and healthy suddenly gets this aggressive disease.
Okay. Did you have a lot of support as well?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, my partner was great as well. I was quite lucky in some ways because I did live by myself, and so I had time to kind of just be sick and a mess. But yeah, what amazed me was that it kind of came out of the woodworks. And so people that you just wouldn't even imagine, for instance, I had this woman who would just turn up every Tuesday with food. and I hadn't seen her in person in about 10 years. You know, it was yeah. things like that would just sort of come in. And I've been thinking since you sort of mentioned it, that, you know, how much faith came in it, into it for you. You know, how important was that to you throughout that process to be able to have faith or a relationship with God to get you through it?
That was probably our saving grace, I think. Just having, because it provides a sense of security, I suppose. You know, you have that extra thing to hold on to. Faith is amazing and just really gives you a sense of peace and a sense of ease, because it's so easy to spiral into a deep, dark place, I suppose, if you're not careful or if you allow yourself to spiral. I've never actually spiraled before. But, you know, I can just imagine how you can go from this to that sort of place because of the crazy emotions you go through when you experience cancer.
Oh, absolutely. I have to admit I spiraled. I spiraled. It was because I had been through about 2 or 3 years prior to it of just every year something happening. And so by the time I had cancer, it was kind of, I didn't quite know how to process it because it was like, are you serious? And I think that's something I've learned through my own cancer experience and then talking to people, is that there actually isn't a limit in life of what people go through, unfortunately. And it would be wonderful if we could kind of have like this limit of grief or a limit of, you know, bad things. But,
you know, oh, you've had your dash for a lifetime.
Yeah.
It's going to happen to you. Yeah. I spiraled a little bit, but not so much into a deep, dark hole or anything like that. But, you know, it's just crazy, hey, all the emotions that you need to deal with and juggle.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't even know how to explain it.
Yeah, it is difficult to put it into words. I was thinking about this recently because I still I haven't had reconstruction, and I think about how much your body changes through cancer and then I guess just through the process of getting older, and that, you know, we often don't see bodies like ours or, you know, in the mainstream media or on social media and things, and how to kind of just, you know, feel comfortable in the post-cancer body, because I think, you know, we do look different. I think even when you've had reconstruction, often, you know, you still know that that's a bit different to your other breast.
I don't know if it's something you ever get used to. Like, I accept my body, but I'm still not used to it. So my daughter, the second daughter, she'd be 21 this year, 22 years.
Wow, yeah.
And I just learned to live with how it is.
Yes.
I say, well, that's beautiful or anything like that, because I'm not really happy with how I look on the inside. But, you know, what a blessing we get to wear clothes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I had one breast off because, well, this is the interesting thing, is that I wasn't offered the choice of having both off. I was told that I could have one off, but they don't take two off if the other one is healthy and things. But I actually wish I'd had both off because
So did they say to you, so that they don't do that because the other one's healthy?
Yeah. Yeah. Were you given the choice?
No, I wasn't. And I was thinking, because I was so young, I didn't even think to ask about that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I get a lot of sort of pain in the other breast because it's like you go through the menstrual.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's a monthly thing, but everything is intense and focused on the one side. Now it's not spread across. Not like a complaining sort of person, but, you know, a couple of times a year I'm saying, oh, I'm getting pains in here, and they're saying, oh, that's normal. And I'm like, man, I wish that I just had.
Yeah.
Nothing. I had both sides taken off.
Yes. Me too. Yes,
you didn't get that option.
No.
Well, I must either, because because it was so long ago, I forget a lot of the detail.
Yeah.
And because I was so traumatized at the time,
yeah,
I forget a bit of the detail, and Watson remembers quite a bit of the detail, but
yes.
I'm pretty sure it offered the choice. Yeah. But in hindsight, you wish that you had a double as well.
I do, because I wear a prosthesis, and what's happened is, because I put on weight afterwards, my other breast is now bigger, and I feel like you can really tell that I've got these two odd breasts. And I think it would have been really nice to have been given the choice just to go flat, and then I could wear two prostheses that are the same. Yeah. Okay.
And then I had put on weight after the baby, and then I have to like top up the other side, the prosthesis side, with socks or something, the fluffy socks.
Yeah.
Just try and balance out, you know, how you look in the front there.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. And then you have other sorts of challenges. Like I went swimming in the school swimming sports, and then one day it fell out in the pool, and I said to my friend, oh, my gosh. Out, and she just dived straight into the to the pool, you know, floundering around trying to find it. And she goes, I've got it. And I'm like, oh, all these sorts of embarrassing challenges that you have to face, you know. And
yes,
I say, oh, what have you got topping up today? Is it a hat or is it a pair of socks?
Oh my gosh, yes, I relate to this so much. Yeah. It's just, although I have to say I'm kind of, I'll be coming up to 3 years post-diagnosis this year. And I think one of the things I'm glad I did is that I just try to get as used to possible as seeing myself with just one boob, and that even just going out sometimes without my prosthesis in, because I sort of had that thing of, well, it's your problem if you, you know, you see one boob lady.
But you know that if you do that, that some people just look there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you're having a conversation with them, but their eyes aren't even focused at your at head level. Sometimes you can tell when people are looking up and down. And then I'm like, so I don't like going out without the other side now. I sort of try to make it all as even as possible before I leave the house. Or if people know that you've had cancer, they sort of like glance down just to have a look. I'm like, mate,
it was this one.
Yeah,
I did want to ask about your mockel, because it is so beautiful, and the process of watching it in the Wakahuia episode was really like, it was really beautiful to be able to listen to your story and to understand what the process is of deciding to get it and the design and things. And I wanted to know how have things changed for you? Has it brought a different sense of peace or grounding to you?
I suppose it has brought a lot of peace and grounding to me. Like I mentioned in the documentary that with my upbringing, I sort of had a mixed identity challenges that are, you know, because I've got a Māori mother and a Pākehā father, and I was brought up in a multicultural area in Tokoroa. My mother didn't sort of focus on her. We didn't really know my Māori side of my family, so I wasn't really brought up with anything Māori. It wasn't until my last year of high school that I was thinking, you know, I wanted to find out who I was and where I'm from and all about my Māori side. When I left school and I went to university, I met Watson in my first year at university in 1989, and he was very pro-Māori, sort of the opposite of what I was. And then from then on, you know, once I was with Watson for probably around 3 years before we decided to get married, and then he had Hana Te Kōwhai, our eldest daughter, and he said to me that he wanted to speak Māori to our daughter. So I did, you know, speaking Māori and learning the reo. We spoke to her in te reo for the first 7 years of her life. We didn't speak English to her, but then she got better than me and I couldn't keep up, so I changed over to English. Probably from around that time, I've only had two teaching jobs in schools, and I've been in Māori medium education. So once I met Watson, after probably when our daughter was born, I sort of gained this passion for Māori medium education. And then that's where our focus has been for the last 28 years, on Māori medium education. So I've learned te reo, not to a super proficient level, but, you know, enough to work in a kura. And then I decided that I've been teaching for a while, and I was with the identity thing, you know, I was thinking that I wanted to feel Māori.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that, you know, I've been humming and hawing for the past 5 years about whether to get my kauai done, because there were some internal challenges that I was facing. Like, one, if you have the kauai, do you need to be super proficient in te reo? Two, would I have to take on extra responsibilities having the kauai, like when you turn up to the marae or to a pōhere and they're going to say, you need to do the karanga and you need to do this and all those sorts of things. And then in my mind, I was thinking, well, you know, I can if I need to. I'm not saying that I'm at the top level or anything, but, you know, I can probably work my way through those sorts of things if I need to. And I wanted it to be something that I wanted to, I don't know what the word is, something for my girls so that they know that this is an inherited right. You don't have to be of any type of particular status. You don't need to have any extra mana or anything, because it's a birthright. That's what I've learned. And when I spoke to my tohunga who gave me the kauai, he told me that it's a birthright. If you're Māori, then it's a right that you have and you can claim that, you know. Yeah. But yeah, that sort of, you know, having my initial discussions with him, that really gave me an inner peace, knowing that I don't have to be some sort of superstar Māori girl to get my kauai done.
It was a real privilege, to be honest, to be able to watch that. I felt like it was really, yeah, just to be able to have some insight into this is, you know, this is what it means.
Yeah. It's just given me a huge inner peace. Mm. Like, I even noticed that I have kauai.
Yeah.
Until I, like, when I brush my teeth, I'm like, oh, yes. Okay. Ooh.
Hello.
And when I see myself in the mirror or something like that.
And I was curious about, with the design of the kauai, do your life experiences influence the design, or is it your whakapapa? How do you decide on the design?
Yeah, so one of our nieces, Edina Corpus, she's an artist, and yeah. I said, darling, you know, how do I go about this? And she said to me, Auntie, first of all, you have to pick the person that you want. So in my world, there's nobody like the man that I chose. He's an amazing artist and an amazing person. And then she said, then you need to put all your trust in that person. So I had a discussion with Derek, my Watson, and he goes into your whakapapa, where you're from, who you're connected to, and then he talks about your life experiences. And then he spoke to other people that were close to us about me and my life experiences and what I'm passionate about, you know, that I'm a teacher and I love education and, yeah, all of my passions and whānau focused and all of those sorts of things, love te ao Māori. And then he is the one that gives me this tonga. But my mum and dad, prior to the event, they both said to me, so what is it going to look like, you know? Can you show me a picture? And I said to them, oh, it doesn't actually work like that, Mum and Dad. You know, I've just had a discussion with him and he's the one that's going to give me what he thinks I should have. And they said, oh, like, what do you mean? And my dad said, oh, well, what is it going to look like? And I said, yeah, well, I don't know. And then they wanted to know what was I going to have, coloured in lips or outlines, patterns? And I said to them, yeah, like I said, I don't know. So, yeah, basically I just put all my trust in Derek, and I didn't know what it was going to look like till he drew the outline on my face, and then he told me I could have like a couple of minutes break. He said, you can go and have a look if you like in the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom and I was like, oh, yes, I love it. And then people asked me, you know, because I always thought I was going to get my lips done. And then they asked me, are you still going to get your lips done, you know? And I said to them, no, this is the tonga that Derek's given me. This is what I'm supposed to have.
Wow. Yep,
so we just truly believe in that.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, that's quite an amazing amount of trust to have in someone, isn't it? I love that you put that into someone and they come up with something.
Yeah. So once you get that inner peace, that once you know, because you're sort of figuring out who you're going to choose, you know, because you've got to choose somebody that you're comfortable with. And this man is a master. This man is the top guy, you know, so you've got to, and then when I was talking to him, I just feel that instant connection, and we're connected whakapapa wise, and just that instant connection that I felt to him. I said to my husband, this is the best decision ever that we've made, is choosing
this amazing man, you know. And then I just felt at ease once we'd had that initial discussion, felt at ease totally that I'm just putting my full trust into him. Because I knew that whatever I get, it's going to be that for the rest of my life. But that's why you've got to put a lot of thought into it, eh, and choose the right person, you know, and having that family support around. And then he said to me that, you know, what is in his mind at the beginning of the journey, like when I start laying on the table, doesn't mean what I'm going to get by the end. Like he may change it up. He said to me, I'm going to read the room and feel, you know, because I might feel that I need to change parts of it because of how, you know, just reading the room. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's just on another level. Floating on this level and he's floating on this level. So I was like, wow, wowee.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me. It has just been so lovely to be able to talk to you and find out more about your experience. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I've loved speaking with you too, Helen. It's been awesome, you know, listening to your journey as well.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to have a call with you.
It's been awesome. It's been such a pleasure for me. There's been so many times throughout we're talking, I just get chills from what you're saying, because I just feel, yeah, I just feel a sense of what you've been through, but also the amazing resilience that you have. And I really appreciate that you've shared that with me. It feels like a gift. So thank you. Thanks so much for joining me. The C Word Kiwis Talk About Cancer is every Sunday at 11:55 on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and anytime at www.planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word. Because May is New Zealand Music Month, I'm ending the show with a waiata one of Michelle's close friends wrote for her. Pania Papa wrote, Ki piata te wairua, when Michelle was going through her cancer treatment. Here is Michelle and her kapa haku group performing the waiata.